All right. Thank you, Messieurs Medeski, Schofield, Martin, and Wood, for your rendition of the Robbie Krieger classic. This is KBOO Portland. It's 11 a.m., and it's time for the Digital Divide, featuring special guest Ellen Ullman, author of the new book Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology. So let's get right to it right after this important community announcement.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage in Portland. The community rights movements help cities and towns to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their people and natural areas. At the Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In event, the leaders of Community Rights US will speak, as well as Mark Lakem. Again, that's Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage, 416 Southeast Oak Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to another edition of Digital Divide here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ken Jones, your host for today's show. In this episode, we interview Ellen Ullman, author of the new book Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology. Ellen's both a techie and a masterful writer. After earning an English degree at Cornell in the early 70s, she's worked professionally as a programmer and software engineer, starting back in the early days of personal computing. In fact, she was one of the few female programmers at the time. Life in Code is Ellen's fourth book, a kind of memoir and essays. She's also the author of the memoir Close to the Machine, Technophilia and Its Discontents, and two novels, By Blood, published in 2012 in a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, and The Bug, which was a runner-up for the Penn Hemingway Award for a first work of fiction. And her essays and articles have appeared in publications such as Harper's, Wired, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and Salon. A longtime resident of San Francisco, Ellen has witnessed and describes in her writing the radical changes both to the computer industry and her home city over the past 40 years, along with a few things that unfortunately never seem to change, and we'll cover several of those observations in today's show. Ellen Ullman, thanks for coming into KBOO.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, Ellen, as mentioned in the intro, you were an English major in college at Cornell, and it was the early 70s, so I don't think there was much general exposure to computers in many colleges at the time. The question, I'm sure you've gotten it before, how'd you go from English major to computer programmer?
I had no intention of going into technology in any regard. In about 1972, I ran into a group called the Ithaca Video Project, and it was a time when the Sony Portapak first became available. It wasn't the first, but it was the first generally available video recorder that individuals could own or a group could own. And you could go around and make your own videos and show them and edit them, political works, art. We were, had a sense of being distantly related to Nam June Paik, a very famous video artist who was the first major artist to use the TV screen as a canvas. So I found I really liked working with these machines. And I like having cable over my shoulder and cabling and learning how to put video, audio, splicing, sync generators. And I just didn't expect how much I would enjoy just the machinery itself. And all right, my life went on. You know, at some point you have to leave the college town. You know, very sad when people hang around, isn't it? And moved to San Francisco. A friend was going. I said, okay, take a two-bedroom. And one day, I was walking down Market Street in San Francisco, and in the window of a Radio Shack store, I saw a microcomputer called the TRS-80. I don't know why, I just bought it. It was
really just on a whim like that.
I had like considered things like Heathkit. You know, I thought I'd build myself some speakers. I mean, at that time, you know, hobbyists, electronic hobbyists were many around. Mm-hmm. And Radio Shack was the source. You know, you had soldering guns and you could make boards. And at that, I didn't want to go to that level. I thought, I'm not good at soldering. I tried it. Not good. But, you know, so I had been hanging out there. And when I hadn't seen the machine in the window. So when I saw the machine, I just went in and I said, how much? And I was carrying checks for some reason. And I wrote a check. Right. I brought it home, and I remember exactly where I was living. And I said, okay, I learned to use the port-a-pack, and so how hard can this be, right? Well, it turned out to be harder than I expected. There was something called computer programming, and I thought, well, you know, I can learn that. And you could. I mean, it was an interpreted language on the machine. Should we tell your audience the difference between interpreted and compiled? Pause for a minute.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a compiled language, you write the code and then you run it through the compiler before you have an executable file that the machine understands. In interpreted language, as you enter it, the interpreter immediately executes it for you. At runtime. And you can hold it. You know, you can do it as save it. Oh, you know, you saved it on a cassette, a reel-to-reel cassette. And programs couldn't be bigger than 4K. Now, this is really old-timer stuff. I think I'll go into, like, bad geekdom here for everybody. But
I have the same experience, though. I remember when the floppy disk came out and K-Pro had two drives for it, one for the operating system, one for your apps. And then later the first hard drives were less than 10 megabytes, something like that. It's almost inconceivable today how little the storage was on those.
We weren't very ambitious in what we were doing. I mean, you know, I don't like the idea, like Kevin Kelly's book, What Does Technology Want? Now, to me, that's a terrible question. We're not technology slaves. It isn't telling us what to do. Human desire drives it. You think about something, okay, you get it. Now, God, you can write something. And then you could do something like sort of graphics, and then you want fancier graphics. I mean, each accomplishment opens up a new and deeper desire to go forward. And also in the technology itself, the density that they were able to put on the disk was growing exponentially. Mm-hmm. So every computer you bought could hold everything you've ever had before. I mean, even your 10th computer could hold all the information you'd ever stored on a computer, which is actually a bad thing because you never get rid of your past. I mean, it's not like putting it in the basement. There's no basement. There's no back. You know, there are these files on there, and one day you go click and you read something that you wrote 10 years earlier in a when you were in a really deep mood or a bad mood. And, oh boy, I wish I hadn't come back and seen this. Or a folder called Letters for the Drawer. And you open that as a mistake. They were meant for the drawer and shut the drawer. So that is the danger of being able to store so much. What I liked about those days, I mean, the hardware interested me. When I got that first program running, it was an experience. I was hooked on it. It was very hard. It's easy to do things. You type it in, 2 + 2, it comes on the screen. You could do sort of things, but I tried to do something reasonably hard at the time, which was to chart graphically. We had to use these X's on the screen, mm-hmm. The decreasing amplitude of a bouncing ball, and put in the formula, and then you have to convert it to screen positions.
Right.
And, it sounds trivial now, but when it ran and I saw those bouncing ball trajectories on the screen, I just, it works. And I was hooked. It was a real, I was seduced by the idea that you could go through all of this coding, and then you look at it, and there's a sort of magic in it. It's like thought turned into a machine. You kind of pass your imagination into this machine and make it work. You know, when you write something, does it work? You say to yourself, does it work? You don't know. But with code, you do.
Yeah, you have a great line in the book. You say, to program is to translate between the chaos of human life and the line-by-line world of computer language. I was wondering, is that orderly way of looking at the world, that conversion from chaos to logic, one of the attractions of coding for you?
No, it's one of the horrors. I mean, it's challenging to do that, but, you know, human thought is very complicated. Mm-hmm. And we make associations that come in, orthogonal thoughts, boredom sets in. You go, you have to go away, you think of something else, and things occur to you, and meanwhile all this other code has existed, and it's wrong, and you have to tear it out and put it back in. There are all these demands put on programmers. Now, the tools make it easier and easier today, almost too easy, because the easiness confines the programmer into a certain framework. They are called frameworks.
Yeah, you have one point in the book where you say some of the programming tools are turning programmers into scriveners. You're basically filling out forms. I know the company I work for, Microsoft, was they were well known for that, their Visual Studio. A lot of it was form-based app development.
Right. And that was the movement for open source. I mean, it was, I want to see the actual source. I want to see the program behind this Microsoft framework, that you press a few buttons and up comes the whole structure, the Microsoft idea of how a program internally is organized and what it should look like on the screen. You go, oh, great. Who should program menus anymore? It's ridiculous. And then your thing is, there are little things in the code that say to do, or comments. And you go in there, and it's like the list on the refrigerator, right?
Yes.
And you fill out these little parameters, and I go like, well, this is not what I know as programming. And so the whole movement to open source was to just get our hands back on it, to look at the operating system, to go as far and into the center of the computer as we could, kind of, you know, regain your soul in a way, your dignity as a human being. I'm overstating that, but it really was a return to the source in both senses.
Your first book, Ellen, and I think this relates, was called Close to the Machine. And in this book, Life in Code, you use the term closer to the machine quite a bit. First, let's let the listeners know what you mean by close to the machine. And I think you were getting a little bit there with getting away from Microsoft and towards more dealing directly with the operating system, and you moved to Linux.
Right. Now everyone has.
Yes.
Well, they were written, the first one was written in 94, and the genesis was Nancy Peters told somebody who was organizing a book, well, call Ellen Ullman, she's a programmer, have her give you something. So that's what's in here. And then the book came later. She said, well, write us a book. And I said, what? She said, well, that, but longer. So that was Close to the Machine. So those ideas did migrate over. The idea of close to the machine is where, what level you're coding at. If you're doing the user interface, well, that's any kind of code you use that humans actually touch or can see or interact with. Well, that's called high-level code because it's farther away from the central operation, the kernel, as it was called in Unix, of the operating system. And so you go through the different layers for different languages that are higher, and then you descend down into C. Assembly language, machine language. And you gain respect as you go closer. I was a C programmer. I looked at, I could read assembler. Sometimes you absolutely had to. But I thought, oh, I don't want to code in this. I looked at device drivers, and I went, that's a nightmare.
Yes.
And, you know, that it works. It never, it works quite right. And so I liked working at sea, and at that point I felt I was low enough. At sea, you become a software engineer. So, and there's more respect. You know, usually low is bad, but in this case, low means lower level code, and that's better. More money, more prestige.
Now, I wanted to kind of move from the machine to the human aspect, which you're well known for, kind of combining that humanistic and that tech perspective.
I don't know about well known. among a select group, yes, I guess they know me.
from your own experiences in the book, it seemed that as you initially got closer to the machine, you also got farther away from in-person relationships with other people. And you write, and I quote from the book, "Ironically, those of us who most believe in physical operational eloquence are the very ones most cut off from the body." And for example, there's a chapter, Come In CQ, which you wrote in 1996. So it's one of the early chapters in the book. You describe a relationship with a coworker, Carl, which was conducted almost entirely online. And the one or two times you tried to connect in person, it didn't go too well. I wondered if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that story of Carl. And
well, I want to make sure you know it isn't online as you think of it. It's internal. It ran over internet protocols, but it was text-based and very ugly command line text, you know, programming. It was command line email.
Okay, I meant that you communicated through the computer, though, rather than face-to-face.
Yes, but I was working. I was a consultant on the project. And I never paid any mind to him. I mean, he was just one of the guys who was always thinking, next time she makes a mistake, we're going to fire her, because who the hell hired this girl? Believe me, it was a difficult group. But I was learning a lot there. They were researchers at Sun Microsystems, which is also gone. May it rest in peace. And so, you know, it's a lot of what I speak about women. You know, if you're learning something here, don't let them drive you away, okay? You're not going to kick me out of this. I'm getting what I want out of this, and I'll give you what you need, but I'm getting what I need. So I endured. Look, I can give as good as I get. Laura Miller wrote in this book from City Lights called Resisting the Virtual Life. She has an essay in there. You know, there was all this publicity about how women were having such a hard time and these bulletin boards. It was very early. And she said, well, yeah, we do, but we give as good as we get. You know, she was really out there, you know, and that really, she was a motivator for me. And she's a friend now. So I am going far afield from your question here.
Oh, it was basically the relationship with Carl. And
so, I didn't notice him very much. But one night I just, you know, was sitting in a dark room with my three computers and humming, and I couldn't sleep. And now I get on and I'm sending some email. And usually, you know, you don't get it back right away. These weren't the days when everyone sat online all the time.
Or with their phones now.
Yeah, all the time. So I got back right away. It was like, I don't know, I guess 2 a.m. And we went back and forth a little. And then he said, well, what are you doing up at this hour and online? I said, same as you. You know, sure, what are you doing? Same thing. So it was sort of like this, I don't know,
flirting.
It wasn't so much a flirt as, yeah, we're both, you know, having a hard night. Mm-hmm. I recognize your, you know, humanity, which I had never noticed at all in him. He was actually sort of a very self-contained man, very, very smart also. And then the next day we had a meeting, and I said, well, there's Carl. And I noticed, actually, he was pretty good looking. And I thought, well, is there anything here that relates to that sensation of knowing somebody in sort of an intimate way, however briefly? No. He was far away, and I said, well, maybe I imagined the whole thing, because he seemed to not notice me in the same way I had not noticed him. But then there were email exchanges. The group was, they pretty much tore each other apart. I mean, if they treated me badly, I'd have to say, well, you know.
They treated everybody badly.
Right. That was their mentality, mm-hmm. You know, just go at criticize, tear out the errors. It's necessary to some degree, but you don't have to do it with so much glee. So one day I was getting excoriated, and suddenly a post from Carl comes up, and he said, "Well, I remember when I was a whipping boy, you know, and I think after this, I will volunteer to be the whipping boy for next week." I'm paraphrasing here.
But very noble.
Well, noble, but, you know, the whipping boy, the public whipping boy. It was like, there's something here. And then we began sending messages back and forth, You know, what we wrote, what we liked. We were both interested in punctuation. It's rare you find somebody who can discuss the colon dash. And finally, we went out. And it was because we had goat dinner. That was the subject line. And it went back and forth for weeks. And it's like, well, we're programmers. It says dinner. We have to go to dinner. And it was very frustrating. As we talked, it was like exchanging email. He talked, stop. I spoke, stop. And the whole form of the conversation was duplicated those emails. And then but it's clear he wanted to hang around. It was nothing emotional about him that he was reaching out. We closed this restaurant. And I said, you want to go home or, you know, should we go somewhere? And I mentioned various things, and I said, the beach. Now, the beach in San Francisco is not what you think about when you think about a beach. It's a gritty, it's gritty, it's cold, it's a feeling of Land's End, nothing but ocean out there. So we went there, we're walking around, and there's a storm blowing in, and we're looking at various things. And he keeps walking. And I think, please, just stop. Just graze your jacket against mine. Touch of some physical sort. And I thought, God, this was awful. I'm just going home. The next morning, early message sent to me, that was wonderful to see you. And what a great night I had. And I'm thinking, you know, I cannot have a relationship with this man, but I wouldn't put down the email. It was a channel to each other. This was the best he could do. And I accepted that as who he was. So I sort of signed off. I left the company, and I said, well, that's it. We communicated for a little while, and it was time to just let them drift off. That's the story.
Do you think there's an inverse relationship then between the closer you get to the machine, the farther you get from other people?
Not necessarily.
Too much of a generalization.
Yeah, that's a generalization, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, Ellen, the book itself, and I want to get to this too, I mentioned it's a series of essays and kind of a memoir in essays. As you said, and we mentioned also, each essay was time-marked for that particular year that you wrote it, going from 1994 to 2017, actually, January 2017. And I wondered why you chose this way of putting the book together rather than, say, looking back on these events as we're doing now in these stories from the perspective of the present.
Well, I wanted to take a snapshot because it would be a very different book to sort of a history of, what I did. Well, it wouldn't be as interesting. I couldn't write a sort of personal or... I didn't want to write a technical book or a history. I wouldn't be good at that, and I have no interest in doing that. I write novels and personal essays, and I've had to accept those are the two genres I can work in as a writer. So I looked at these pieces, and my editor and I, Sean McDonald, agreed that only the best work. I mean, wasn't going to, book reviews, and, if you're a famous writer, you can put those scraps in there, but not me. And we discussed, what the rule would be. Now, you could look back. Essays could look back in time, but they couldn't look forward. They were blind to the future. And to me, that was an important aspect of doing it, that I lived in this moment. I saw what was happening around me. This is how people acted around me at that time in technology. And to just let people see what that was. I could imagine what the future might be out of that, But I wasn't allowed at that point to say, well, see, in 2017, you know, we would do this disintermediation thing. We'd get the middlemen out and people go right to the web. And, well, look, in that piece, I could say Donald Trump, you know, and Twitter. I mean, disintermediation, taking out everyone in the middle between you and the rest of the world. It was a big, it's a topic in there. I think I've strayed. That probably needs more than I've just said about it. So I wasn't allowed to do that. I think that was the right way to do it. I wanted to be ignorant of the future, as I was at the time.
Now, the interesting thing, and what's amazing to me, and you and I talked a little bit about this before the interview, is how visionary some of these essays are.
Seem.
okay, how they seem. The first chapter in the book, which is the first essay you wrote on computers, Outside of Time, Reflections on the Programming Life, that was written in 1994. I want to talk about it. I wonder if you could just read a little from there.
As I said, I saw what was happening in front of me, and I saw it expanding. It's like, okay, you ever have those? This is an old thing, but you have one of these things. It's a little ball, and you put it in the water, and it turns into a flower.
Oh, yes, yes.
I don't know if people still have that, but you can see something opening up. And thinking, well, this is opening really fast. I mean, what occurred to me was this was happening, and the change, the pace of the change suddenly was rapid. In my experience, now I'm sure there are other people who live through other ages who can tell you, well, same for me. So I wasn't seeing the future. I was alarmed and fascinated by this rush of new things that were happening around us. Mostly I was afraid. And hope to, I think when I wrote this, hope to, you know, set up a warning. Watch out. All this is coming upon us, and watch out. So, do you want me to read now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
please.
So you have selected these paragraphs, so I'll read them. Interactive services are supposed to be delivered on demand. What an aura of power. Demand. See a movie, order seats to a basketball game, make hotel reservations, send a card to mother, all services waiting for us on our telephones, televisions, computers, midnight, dawn, or day, sleep or order a pizza. It no longer matters exactly what we do when. We don't need to involve anyone else in the satisfaction of our needs. We don't even have to talk. We get our services when we want them, free from the obligations of regularly scheduled time. We can all live closer to the machine. Interactivity is misnamed. It should be called asynchrony, the engineering culture coming to everyday life. As the computer's pretty, helpfully waiting face and contemptuous underlying code penetrates deeply into our daily life, the cult of the boy engineer comes with it. The engineer's assumptions and presumptions are in the code. That's the purpose of the program, after all, to sum up the intelligence and intentions of all the engineers who worked on the system over time, tens and hundreds of people who have learned an odd and highly specific way of doing things. The system contains them. It reproduces and reenacts life as engineers know it. Soon we may all be living the programming life, alone, floating in mind time, disdainful of anyone far from the machine.
So, Ellen, that's very much like the situation we're in today with on-demand services. And I was wondering, how did you foresee this? And it made me think of the William Gibson quote I told you about earlier. He's famous for saying, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed, when he was asked a similar question.
Well, I suppose the distribution I could talk about is the society of programmers. And it was already here, but also expanding at a rapid rate. It could see this germ kind of suddenly grow at a rapid pace. So I wasn't foreseeing the future. I was seeing what was in front of me in my world of programming, and I feared for what we were doing.
You're listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking today with Ellen Ullman, author of the new book, Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology. There was one point made in your Wordstock talk, and I should tell listeners that this is happening right after you appeared at Wordstock today. You and the author you were with.
Dore Scheffrier. She wrote, her novel is called Startup. A very excellent portrayal of what is happening now in the startup world.
Both of you were talking about certain books that you don't like, and that's by, I think the one that came up was Leaning In by Sheryl Sandberg.
Well, it was a nice interaction. We got along. We're thinking we should take this show on the road. In many ways, we have complementary books. Mine starts in 94 and works forward to 2017, and she starts 2015. And my book kind of leads up to and describes the world that's happening now. And so it was a great pairing in many ways. So there were questioners, you know, how can we proceed? How can women get inside? How can women be more represented in technology? And Dory said, well, one thing, I don't think we should give women advice as to how they should act like men. I don't like books like that. So I said to her, is there one that begins with L? And no, yes, Lean In. There's good advice in there, no doubt, especially if you want to climb the ladder. I never had interest in that. But it is, you have to fit in their culture kind of thing, not we are going to change the culture so we can live in it. And that is the difficulty of having a star out there. I admire her, I have to tell you. I've met her. And
Sheryl Sandberg.
Mm-hmm. She invited a whole group of women to her house one time. And I have to tell you, she has hired all these women who are so fiercely smart, they're scary. I mean, they're regional managers, global managers, marketing gurus. She has really found the women who are capable and smart. Whether they will change the culture or they will be a reflection just with women in it, I don't know yet. It remains to be seen, but she's working out there in the way that she understands it to bring women inside.
We got a question from the audience on changing the culture, and you were somewhat pessimistic on change, or at least you said it would take a very long time.
Generations, hello. How long did it take the world to accept gay people? How many generations did it take?
Well, they're still not accepted in a lot of places.
Exactly, exactly. There are big changes. To talk about women, half the human race, actually more than half in numbers, we're talking about a huge population and changing a culture where women can, I don't know how to say this, men are the default condition. In programming, you have a default. You know, it comes in and, you know, it says, you know, will you accept, you're not carrying hazardous goods. Like, do you have hazardous goods, bringing on the plane? No, that's, right. You know, the default condition. Men are the default condition. And when you see these ads with women in them, it's like exceptional. Men drive the cars. Women drive the cars only when there are children in the back. Otherwise, they sit looking beautiful in the passenger seat.
In these ads.
Yeah. In these ads. Mm-hmm. And so, it's just so deeply ingrained that you don't even think about it. And I spend a lot of time thinking about it. I look at the popular culture. I see parents taking their children down the street, and the boy is, come here, buddy. And the girl is, princess, don't go too far away, princess. Now, that starts really young. I mean, they're toddlers. So when we talk about change at that level, you can see how deep it goes. So the change has to happen so fundamentally. It has to happen, but people have to be dedicated to doing it, and they have to be relentless at doing it.
You had one piece of advice in there. Instead of leaning in, you said your advice was holding on.
Well, just refuse to be kicked out. Uh-huh. You know, you can do this stuff. I know I'm good at it. I like this job. You're trying to intimidate me. I maybe feel intimidated, but I'm not going to act intimidated. You're not kicking me out. Now, it puts a large burden on anyone who faces prejudice, any group who faces it. But there's no way. I mean, we can talk about all these subjects, but finally, when a woman goes into a room full of mostly male programmers, it's going to be there. And so there has to be this internal process. Now, my advice, there is one piece here, one part here. I had a boss who, every time I met with him, he'd just keep interrupting me to say, you know, gee, you have pretty hair. Gee, you have pretty hair. I hate to hire all you girls, but you're all so damn smart. And he would just bring other remarks over. So I just leaned to one side and let that crap fly over my shoulder. I was learning stuff there about relational databases, and I went on to work with them. And I thought, he's not going to drive me out. He wasn't a bad guy. I mean, there are layers of this. There is the actual criminal harassment. And then in the middle are the guys who were jerks. And you tell yourself, these are sub-adult males. They're jerks. They don't know any better. They've been in their treehouse too long. No girls allowed. And it's hard to deal with them, really hard to deal with them. The disdain you face, the pressure to be not only good but better or best. You make a mistake and you're on that dumb girl. And then there are the ones who are just like my boss that I was describing, genial, not intending to hold you back because he did promote women, but always reminding you of your body. Now, that's the thing. Women are kept in their place by the attack on the body. And Ta-Nehisi's book, am I saying that correctly?
I think that's it. Yeah, and he was at Wordstock today.
Ta-Nehisi, of course, he was here today. His book talks about, his first book talks about how the prejudice is in the, on the body, on the black person's body, black man's body. And for women, that's the same thing. I mean, it's sex. Seeing women as sex, pretty, and ultimately you have to get out of that. It's very hard. This is atavistic. So when I talk about changing the culture, I do believe people have to organize locally. This woman asked about schools. I said, form local groups, go to the school, talk about these things, make sure these things are happening. Now, I guess I think about it now, that was pretty class-based. There are lots of parents who don't have the time to do that sort of organizing and work. But perhaps groups, political groups, that can, you know, meet with them, the mothers, the parents, fathers who may not have time to attend, and carry those messages in. But that's what has to be done. Pressure on the ground.
So that certainly goes beyond a woman getting into programming and coding. That's kind of the
That's
way...
That's politics in general.
It's the culture.
As
you said, it's a men's culture. They're the default.
Yeah, men are the default. Mm-hmm. And the same thing when you... I look at ads, and I look at television commercials. I don't turn them off. To me, they're a good indicator. And I watch non-commercial stations most of the time. But not everybody has premium cable. So you just see, suddenly they show you a black family. Now, the black family is indistinguishable from a middle-class family in an SUV, except they have brown skin. They're never too dark. And again, it's the white default. And if you're going to have somebody else in there, like black people, they're suburban. You always see them mowing their lawns and washing their cars. And their neighbor goes, oh, you know, did you just get a new car? Did you get a raise? You know, that Chevy looks like a Cadillac. So I think back to how much work we did in the 70s for women, for all the classes, black people. Do you remember the television program? Oh God, I can't remember it exactly.
The Jeffersons, or
the Jeffersons, and there was one before that. They portrayed
The one with Jimmy Walker, right? Dynamite.
Dynamite. Yeah. Now that ruined the show.
He
was the minstrel clown that otherwise, you know, that softened a blow. But what this was a struggling working class black family. They weren't suburban in their SUVs. Now we don't see that anymore. We don't see things about the working class. We don't see television programs about them. Maybe films somewhere, maybe some premium cable. So how do we get back to organizing, the real organizing that goes to the ground? Facebook is very helpful. You find people and who maybe develop your thinking and urge you on. But ultimately, you have to meet people face to face, and you have to get to know them, and you need to work together as a coherent group that will endure over time due to these strong, we hope, strong personal bonds. And then you can work to change things in your neighborhood, in your ground. I have a friend, you know, she, in California, there's no use doing phone banking for any of our candidates because they're going to get elected.
The Democrats are going to win. Yeah.
So what they have is something called sister districts, where there are places where there are close races, and they do phone banking for that. Theirs was Virginia. Look what just happened to Virginia.
Amazing.
Yes, right. Amazing.
They're about to take over the state legislature.
Exactly. I mean, my friend was delirious. So I know this is going on, but to me, this is how change is done. And it's hard. So when people ask me, how can you change the culture? You've got, imagine the biggest floating object you can imagine that takes up most of the Gulf of Mexico or the Pacific Ocean and trying to turn it around.
So baby steps.
Yeah, you know, degree by degree.
Yeah, you also mentioned in the book, and I remember reading about this because it wasn't too long ago, some of the virulent resistance to combating sexual discrimination in the computer industry. You have a quote here, but the world of computer gaming is usually overpopulated by, again, white and Asian men and famously hostile to women. When the organizers of the 2015 technology conference South by Southwest put on the agenda two panels about sexism and sexual harassment in the gaming community, they received threats of violence if they did not remove the panels. They removed the panels.
Exactly.
They caved.
They caved. They put something online, but wouldn't put people in the room because they really were, I'm not sure if there were death threats. Journalistically, I would have to check that.
It just amazed me, the degree of resistance, though, to something that you'd figure, okay, let's discuss it, let's talk about it, let's look for solutions.
There are hands put out to try to welcome women in. I guess I can't say this either, but you know, it's like, why can't the rhymes with riches, you know, I'll just make it on their own. We didn't get any special help. Why do they need it? And it gets worse and worse from there. It becomes pornographic eventually. There was a Python conference that became sort of famous for wrong reasons, but they had this 12-year-old girl, and it was about trying to welcome girls and women into programming. And they had this wall where they would put up yellow stickers about their reactions to what was going on. And within a day, even not a full day, the comments on the yellow stickies were pornographic. Hostile and pornographic. And again, the woman's body is how you reduce her. You reduce her to her sexual body.
And we didn't even bring up the James Damore memo, the Google employee who was very discriminating about not going overboard to help women in tech, and that they're not suitable to the position.
We don't have time. I can cite the one thing I talked about, but we don't have time to talk about the science about this because
right.
Everyone accepted there was scientific proof. So I sat down and I read the study. It's a meta study of five other studies. I didn't read the underlying five studies, but they use these characteristics, six characteristics, where like, I don't know, affectionate or I don't know, various kind of neutral terms to describe people's temperament and personality. But there's one that's called neuroticism. It's not a neutral description. It's a clinical assessment. It ended with a really counterintuitive finding, which was that in countries that women are more welcomed into the culture, the women had, you know, more posts and there were fewer obstacles to them, they scored higher on neuroses, okay? Mm-hmm. And the women in more traditional cultures were low on that score. And there was Damore saying, well, you see, women can't make it. You know, we let them in and they become...
neurotic.
Without saying that word, high on neuroticism, you know, uh-huh. implies that judgment.
Right.
And so normally when you have a scientific study that comes to something that's counterintuitive, you say, well, what else could be causing this? That is what you do. I mm-hmm. learned enough about reading studies and in reading about biology in college and so forth, had a great teacher. And you look at this and you say, well, this is unexpected. Why is this so? Or you say, this is good for further study. Maybe someone else will pick this up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said to myself, well, of course, women in traditional cultures are not being asked to play two roles. They're in one role. And whatever difficulties they have, they can perform that role well or not.
Mm-hmm.
Women who are working, let's say, and trying to be software engineers, have to live in both of those worlds simultaneously. They still have to go home and take care of the kids. Even if the husband's involved or the partner, she's doing the organizing. Honey, here's the schedule where the children are. Da, da, da. She's got to give him the agenda. I don't know how there are men I know who are surely not like this. But so this woman has to perform well in two worlds simultaneously and is belittled if she has to go do something to take care of a sick kid. So why is she, I wouldn't call it neurotic. I really looked at it and I said, well, this is uneasiness, anxiety.
Anxiety, yes.
It's anxiety.
Stress.
Stress.
You've got
and
all
so
this
why would you score high on that? Well, because you're being asked.
You are stressed.
You are stressed. And I guarantee any man who had those responsibilities would feel the same stress.
Right.
He would be neurotic too. We hope not. We don't wish anybody to be neurotic.
Now, the last thing I want to cover, since this program is called The Digital Divide, that's something you actually go into in the book. Not just the world, but specifically San Francisco. You're talking about one-third of us have access to computers and the internet. Two-thirds of the world do not. So right away, there's a situation there that's extremely uneven and just seems to be getting worse. I was wondering what you see as a solution to that. In the book, you mentioned, and you actually did this, you explored the world of a massive open online courses as a way of getting people digital education where they could at least understand coding, maybe even become programmers themselves. Do you feel that that's still the solution to this digital divide, to get more people involved?
Well, first of all, more people need to know what a program is. They need mm-hmm. We need to demystify this whole notion of code and algorithms. We are ensnared by algorithms, and we can't be active against them unless we know more about it. I forgot to mention today at Wordstock that I have a culture hero. A councilman in the Bronx put up a bill saying that all the algorithms the borough uses, this is in New York, mm-hmm. to make decisions need to be examined for potential bias. And these algorithms decide what schools kids go to, police schedules, assignments of garbage pickups. I mean, these are entire city services that are based on algorithms.
Which are written by humans who have their own biases.
Right. So I think that's it. That is exactly what we need to do. We need to piece by piece by piece. Now, that involves finding people who are willing to work for what the Bronx can pay.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Might not be as much as Facebook or Google.
Well, the guys from Google's are not going to rush out and say, I want to do this as for a living, right? So we have to create a new army of programmers mm-hmm. who come from various backgrounds, who want to work in the civic sphere. How do we do this? Well, as we discussed, working in the schools, not just for women, but for all social classes and races and so forth.
Right.
When I looked at the MOOCs, the online courses, I found that the social values got broadcast right through them. You couldn't avoid it. The teachers, the professors have their own assumptions, and out they come. And so,
and they probably don't realize that they're making those assumptions.
They don't. Actually, I had an excerpt of the piece that discussed that that ran in Harper's, and Harper's did all this fact-checking. They contacted the people involved. And so the professor who taught the gaming course rejected the notion that I said it was a, you know, highly male-dominated world. He just refused. He said, no, that's not true. What do you do with that? And he's a gamer, and you see him playing. The camera's on there. He's going, ka-choo, ka-choo, ka-choo. Ah, yeah. He loves it, and he looks great doing it. And he's not aware of, also he talks about Spock and sort of Trekkie stuff and insider things of Monty Python's Flying Circus and all the people in the world and all the social classes.
They don't necessarily.
And how old are they? How young are they? These cultural assumptions about American culture and American geek culture, I think, would flabbergast some people and excludes them. So I think people would look at them and they have to go armed with knowledge that they're going to encounter that and say to themselves, I'm going to take it anyway. You can download the videos and you just, you know, poke your pen in the eye of this guy on the screen. Just, you know, he's just some pixels. I don't have to believe what he says. I want to learn how to do this particular thing. I want to learn to program Python, and I'm going to get it.
Ellen, I want to end on a somewhat brighter note. And I'm going to quote again from your book. I went by the cafes again in San Francisco, this is. Suddenly, I wanted to race in and shake those privileged young people out of their internet dreams. I wanted them to see the damage the net is doing to our culture, banishing privacy, widening the divide between rich and poor, hollowing out the middle class, the creation of a segregated, cloistered society of technologists who barely see the real lives of the majority of human beings on Earth. Yet I must force myself to see the good the young dreamers might do. I was wondering, what is the good you're hoping those young dreamers do?
Well, there are people who are programmers who work with, like, Code for America. They're, you know, it isn't perfect. They are joining, they are coming and working there, and they work for nonprofits. They do get paid. There's, you know, how these programmers get paid. They have to get paid. They have to make a living. So it's a complicated thing. But programmers are going in and saying, I want to work on something else besides a search engine that unveils personal life. This is not my goal. I have to just, I don't know what they're going to do. You see, they're another generation, two now. Mm-hmm. One that never had life, that the internet wasn't there, and another that barely remembers life before. So they're going to do things I can't imagine. I just have to believe that they will find their way. I have to. I'll be in despair otherwise. And that was, today we had a talk, and millennials were kind of disparaged. And I see that too. I talk about it. The privileged young people in the cafes, they're millennials. But if you don't believe in the next generation, how can you be alive? I mean, one of the things we are as human beings, you know, we know there's people in the past before we lived, and there'll be people alive, you know, after we're dead. And if you don't think that something good will happen, or believe against all evidence, which is what I'm saying here, I must believe, okay? It doesn't say I do believe, right? I have to hope, yes. Right? You see, this is willed. Uh-huh. This is willed optimism, because, as you know, I am a gloomy person.
Ellen Ullman, again, thanks so much for joining us today at Cable on Digital Divide.
Thank you. This was really a great talk. I enjoyed it so much.
We've been talking with Ellen Ullman, author of the new book, Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Digital Divide on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Ellen for talking with us at KBOO, to Rabia Yeaman for letting this longtime computer nerd guest host, and to all of you for listening.
That's right, cats and kitties. It's KBOO Portland. It's 11:56 a.m. That means, in 3 minutes and change, I'm going to hand you over to the one and only, the inimitable, accept no substitutes, take no wooden Don Jacobsons, because only the genuine article can bring you an hour and a half of Moving On, featuring the best roots Americana folk music that you will ever hear anywhere in this or any other universe. So stay tuned for that, because that's coming up on your community radio, which means it's your responsibility to fund it. Keep it fierce, strong, and independent. Those of you who called with a promise of financial support, make sure you fulfill that promise. Consummate your pledge immediately. If you missed your chance during our recent holiday membership drive, you can still become a member of the KBOO Foundation anytime at kboo.fm/give, and or when you land on the homepage, click on donate. Thank you so much for listening to the AMPA block on this Friday morning. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage in Portland. The community rights movement helps cities and towns to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their people and natural areas. At the Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In event, the leaders of Community Rights US will speak, as well as Mark Lakem. Again, that's Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage, 416 Southeast Oak Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From now until December 15th, please drop off clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves at the following locations: Cloud City Ice Cream on 45th and Southeast Woodstock, Cup and Saucer at 30th and Northeast Killingsworth, Fire on the Mountain at 57th and Northeast Fremont, Los Gorditos at 12th and Southeast Division, and here at KBOO Community Radio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The folks at Zippity News will pick up all donations on December 15th and distribute them to local shelters. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing. Because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world and that if it's hit you pretty hard,